It's a great pleasure to welcome back Jason Siborski, who, if you've been listening to the Roadhouse the last 3 weeks or so, you've heard us talking about him, and you may have heard me interview him back on, or I don't know how many weekends ago it was, but I know it's been 3 weeks since he started this trek that he made from Atikokan, Ontario, locally, I'm sure everybody knows where that is, up on the top of the Quetico, and he bushwhacked without a watercraft all the way down to Ely, where his outfitting business is, Ely Outfitting Company, and where he is joining us now on the phone, safe and sound, dry, well-fed, I assume.
Thanks, Dick. It's great to be back, and nice to be chatting with you again.
Do you have anything to add about how many miles it was and how many days it took? And
well, you know, it took 15 days.
Yep.
And
you predicted 14, didn't you? I mean, you were almost right on.
Well, I actually predicted 15.
I didn't mean to suggest that you didn't predict it, Greg. Good.
I kind of got lucky on that. It was 14 days in Quetico and the BWCA, and then the 15th day was walking from the edge, the southern border of the BWCA, into the shop in Ely.
Oh yeah,
that was day 15. But the kind of the wild card was exactly how many miles it was going to be when I was bushwhacking, because I had this plan and I'd drawn these lines on Google Maps. But I didn't really know what it was going to turn out to be. And it turned out to be a little longer than I thought. It turned out to be a 90-mile trek.
Uh-huh.
And 63 of those miles were in either Quetico or the BWCA, and went all out bushwhack and swim. And then the 27 miles was on either kind of shoulder between Atikokan and Quetico and the BWCA border and the shop in Ely here.
I was noticing on your website you had a red line track. Is that the line you predicted ahead of time?
That was
on your map?
And, you know, I just kind of downloaded everything off the GPS, and I can put the new line up, but the new line is really close.
It is. although I did see at least once or twice when you say where your campsite was, it wasn't right on the line, you know, but you were pretty darn close.
Right. So, I stayed closer to it than I thought I might.
How about your whole communication setup and your navigation setup? How did it work? And did it work or not? And what worked well and what didn't work so well?
Sure. So a large part of my weight was technology on this trek.
Your weight was 50 pounds is when you started, I think, right?
Right, and it's specced out, like, right down to the pound at 54 pounds.
Oof.
The water bottle's empty, and is what it ended up being just before I left, and kind of once I got everything pulled together. But for technology, I brought the iPhone, which worked as my GPS. I used an app called Motion X GPS, so I could always take a look at that and see exactly where I was at. And I downloaded the satellite imagery and then also the shaded topos, so I could look at them right on my iPhone.
And that app allowed you to track your route all the way
right.
On.
And I was really good. I didn't forget too much to turn it on a couple of times for a little while. But so that actually drew the breadcrumb track of exactly where I went. And it showed me how far I'd gone that day and how long I'd been traveling and such.
And
so that was all right there in a little iPhone that I carry in my, on me all the time when I'm anywhere.
But your iPhone would not work for communication, but it was your navigation device.
Right. So it's interesting. Some of the iPhone model that I have, the 5, allows the GPS system to work even when there's no cell service. That's not the case for all iPhones. Like, I don't know if the iPhone 4 can do that,
mm-hmm.
for example. And also, you need to have cell service on your phone in order to get the map imagery, to get the satellite images and the shaded topos, mm-hmm. unless you download all of those actually to the hard drive on your phone in advance, which is what I'd done. And so I had pretty amazing, you know, imagery right on the phone.
Well, that's all of our listeners out there who are planning a trek like that, this sounds like the ticket. You should have an iPhone 5 and Jason's app. but you communicated to the outside world all along your trek. And how were you doing that?
Right. And I was doing that similarly to the iPhone with spare batteries. So I definitely had rechargeable batteries for the phone to fully recharge it 1.5 times a day. But then I also had a satellite phone, and then I had 3 spare batteries, or the main battery and 2 spares for the sat phone. And so in the evenings, since I was trekking solo, I'd sit in my tent in the evenings and journal out on paper. And then the following morning, I tried to call in a sat phone update, reading out of my journal. And then I had a friend back home who was updating our Facebook page with my daily journal updates.
Oh, that's how you did it. Because, I mean, it was great text, great writing of your descriptive wording there, and I thought, well, he's not calling that in, he's writing that somehow. And I thought you had some way to upload text, but you just called it in and dictated it, basically.
Yeah, I was very fortunate that I have a friend who has a little business called True North Adventures, and he does some of the social media stuff in Ely here, and so he took my transcription and kind of managed the social media part of it while I was on trail.
Well, the last question on communication stuff is, did you have a spot device or an emergency transponder of some kind?
No, I did not. And part of that was just shaving ounces. And
That's kind of a risky thing to shave, isn't it?
Well, I had the sat phone. I knew the sat phone that I've used a lot, so I was really comfortable with it. And I knew also, because I had my cell phone, I knew that if on some of these high ridges, as I got closer to Ely, I was going to be able to get out a message if I needed to. But right, no, I'm at the shop right now, and I'm looking right at the spot that I'm taking. And then I'd never had a trip where I weighed everything on little food scales and shaved ounces. But I was literally shaving ounces on this trip.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about finding campsites. You were off the beaten path. You were not necessarily going to be able to find well-used campsites. How tough was it?
Well, you know, I did not even see rocks put together in a fire ring until day 12 when I reached the international border in the Basswood River. I didn't even see that. I didn't see a spot that looked like anybody'd ever camped before.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah,
and you know, and I did had a little bit of a snafu, you know, on that first day when I lost one of my water bottles that popped out of the pouch on the side of my pack,
right,
and sort of disappeared. That changed things a little bit because I really needed a lot of water to stay hydrated, which is, you know, if you're on a summer canoe trip up here and you forget all your water bottles, so what?
Doesn't matter.
You dip your head over the side of the canoe and
right.
All is well. But you know, when I was only traveling about a half a mile per hour oftentimes, sometimes less, sometimes more, I could be easily an hour away from a decent water source. So I had to be. I camped near lakes and beaver ponds and streams as much as I could.
And I saw you were at some point. You were on Sturgeon Lake or near Sturgeon Lake.
Right.
And it was kind of amusing because I don't think it was a night we talked to you, but it was another night I spoke with Daniel Alvarez recently, who's the guy who went from Northwest Angle to Key West and back with his kayak, and he went down Sturgeon Lake about 6 days before you got there. That would have been so cool.
Pretty close.
If you guys could have met.
Yeah, that would have been pretty amazing because, you know, I did not see a soul for the entire time that I was in Quetico in the BWCA. I didn't even see a canoe in the distance or a tent in the distance or anything the entire time, which kind of amazed me because I did have some, you know, some clifftop vistas looking down the lake.
Oh,
I
sure.
thought I'd find some solo paddler like him, maybe, somewhere out in the distance, but I didn't.
Yeah, that's fascinating. How about keeping on your route? Was that the iPhone helped you with that, how did you keep going straight when you're breaking through dense brush like that?
You bet. So I had I carried a wrist compass, and so I pretty much constantly looked at my wrist compass to take a bearing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there were some places where you could find that, you know, tree in the distance and sort of, you know, try and walk toward it. But most of the time, it was dense thickets. And so I just had to keep watching, you know, my wrist compass, and I just kept going in that general direction. And had faith that wrist compass was working, but I could also check it because I could look at the breadcrumbs on my mm-hmm. GPS unit, and it would show, sure enough, hey, I was going in a straight line heading south.
I know you had some weather stuff out there, and I remember before you left, I asked you if you're going to have a solar charger, and you said you didn't think you're going to see much sun, and that proved to be about correct, didn't it?
It was pretty perceptive. Holy moly. It was a lot snowier than I had expected. And I think we got more snow than on trail where I was at than places like Ely got. I'm not sure about Grand Marais.
No, but I don't think we had anything like you had. I mean, there was snow up the trail here, but... You know, I saw the little video you've got posted on your website, and everybody should take a look at that website. It's actually on your Facebook page, EelyOutfittingCompany.com.
Yep.
And he's got this. You got this great video of you going through the snow.
Right, and you know, the first half of the trip was kind of wet and kind of sunny and pretty warm, but the second half, the weather really changed, and it felt a lot more like mid-December than mid-October. I was kind of trudging through 3+ inches of snow in places, and it was a winter wonderland, so to speak. But, you know, these conditions, the weather conditions were, once the snow came, and it stayed for days on end, unlike a typical October, you know, snow, you get a little snow overnight and it melts by the afternoon or whatever. But this just sort of kept piling up and was a lot more challenging to keep comfortable in than, say, camping at 30 below.
Sure.
Far more challenging.
I'm sure it was. I'm speaking here with Jason Zaborski of Ely, who last week completed his trek through the Quetico and the Boundary Waters from Atticoken to Ely. We're learning about some of the issues that he dealt with, and there's a lot more information if you want to follow his Facebook account, like I said. Now, you're just talking about weather, and you're basically touching on the hypothermia threat. Did you ever feel like you were having a close call on either weather or any other wetness-related issue?
You know, it's pretty uncomfortable for a couple of days, and my feet were actually pretty cold for a couple of days, which is just something that I had to manage, and I just tried to stay extra hydrated and keep moving and keep feeding calories in to feed my fire, and I was fine, but you know, these, you know, right around freezing and you know, really humid and really wet, I mean, those are hypothermia conditions, and I was just being extra careful as I was traveling.
I noticed on one occasion, I think, you basically stayed in the tent all day because it was, that was early on, fairly early on, and it was raining.
Right.
So that was your only real break on the whole trip.
Right. It was on day five, and by day four, with four full days of bushwhacking really hard through some really dense thickets, I was feeling pretty beat up. And I remember laying in my tent, and all along I thought that, you know, around day five would be probably a decent time to take a layover day and recharge and reassess. But my legs from my ankles through my thighs were black and blue, a little bit like somebody had taken a baseball bat to me. And the reason for that is I was just really kind of aggressively for the first 4 days kind of pushing through all down trees and brush.
I can imagine it. I remember when we talked before you left, I read you that little piece by Alvarez about swimming through the brush, basically. You know, you just kind of crash your way through, don't you?
There are places where I would kind of turn my head downward and put my hands behind my back with the palms facing out, and I'd kind of make myself kind of bullet-like, and I would just lean in to the brush. and I would just push through. And that worked well, particularly after I learned that I needed to keep my hands all the way behind my back with my knuckles in, because my knuckles were getting raked over so hard by all the brush and, scraped up.
Well, the other thing that was a major issue for you to deal with was crossing water where you had to swim. And you've got a great video on the Facebook page when you're crossing the Basswood River.
Right.
And you say in that swimming is the most hazardous aspect of the trek as far as you're concerned. Is that?
Well, you know, I just have a real respect for water. And you know, I used to guide rafting trips and did swift water rescue training. And, you know, when you're on water enough, you just know that your, you know, margin of error should be less. And so I tried to, you know, make sure my swims were as short as possible and as safe as possible. And they really worked well. I stayed drier and warmer and more comfortable, typically, when I was swimming than when I was crashing through these snow-covered trees.
Yeah, and I mean, you described how you were going to do it, but anybody who really wants to see it, look at that video. He does a great job of making the video. I mean, just, you know, the camera work that you had there all by yourself. What was the camera floating on?
I couldn't believe that I was taking my iPhone along for all this, but that's the only camera I took. And what I did, I don't know if you can tell, I took my trekking pole, my trekking poles were just lifesavers. I can't imagine doing the trip without them, to give myself sort of that four-leg feeling of using trekking poles. But I just basically tied it on to the end of my trekking pole and held it, and then swam across the Basswood River with, you know, one hand swimming.
Well,
and
you mean you were holding the phone up? I thought you were floating it on something.
I swam across with one arm, basically tied behind my back.
Well, it was a great job. Great piece of cinematography, really. I'm curious about just basically what would you have brought that you didn't, or what would you have left home that you took? Anything?
Wow.
Like a little pack raft?
No, the water crossing system was perfect. The water crossing system worked. I could not have worked any better, frankly.
It sounds like basically everything worked as you planned it.
Well, you know, particularly well. I mean, when I was swimming across, I was thinking that I wish I had a fishing pole to troll, frankly. I've actually wondered what it would be like. You know, people have these high hip waders, but my dry suit actually only weighed 1.8 pounds, and you know, I could step in it. I'm thinking, geez, maybe I should take this thing on summer fishing trips.
Absolutely, yeah. That's a very lightweight for all the protection it offers.
Yeah, I'd really jettisoned everything that I didn't think I needed.
You didn't jettison anything on the trip itself, did you?
No. Okay. No. The only thing I jettisoned was my toilet paper that I burned along the way, because it's just one of those wilderness ethics things.
Sure.
It's just so important that people either pack out or burn their toilet paper. And, you know,
that's a big Quetico issue for sure.
It is a big leave no trace Quetico issue. If I could have brought fresh socks for every single day of the trip.
Oh, yeah. Hard to get them dry once they got wet, I bet, huh?
I had wet feet for the entire trip for 14 days.
Okay, what about, did you ever doubt that you'd make it?
You know, I wondered if it was going to take longer than I planned, but I certainly thought this is a trip that I could really easily turn an ankle or twist a knee and have to have some friends paddle out to get me.
Sure, or even, just too difficult to do. Too strenuous to get through all that stuff that you went through. And
sure. I think that's one of the interesting things. So many of the people that I talked to before the trip, when I brought it up, their response was, is that even possible?
I guarantee you that was my thought as you were saying you were going to do that. And I was wondering, literally, and I don't mean I doubt you at all, Jason, but I thought, man, I'm not sure he can do that. And you did it. You did a great job with it. It's been a fascinating story. I'm not even going to ask you what you're going to do next, because I'm sure you're not going to do that kind of a thing again, but you'll have something, knowing you. I really, really appreciate you taking all the time you have with us twice now to talk through this and explain it all. I'm sure everybody out there is interested in it and can find more on your Facebook page, as I mentioned, EleeOutfittingCompany.com. Jason, welcome home, and thank you very much.
Dick, thanks a lot for having me. It's really been a pleasure.
Our pleasure, too.